yogi should then meditate.
The yogi should then meditate.
On the chest of the Supreme Personality of Godhead.
On the chest of the Supreme Personality of Godhead.
The abode of the Goddess Mahalakshmi.
The abode of the Goddess Mahalakshmi.
The Lord's chest.
Is
the source of all transcendental pleasure.
Is the source of all transcendental pleasure.
For the mind.
For the mind.
And full satisfaction for the eyes.
And full satisfaction for the eyes.
The yogi should then imprint on his mind.
The yogi should then imprint on his mind.
The neck of the personality of Godhead.
The neck of the personality of Godhead.
Who is adored by the entire universe.
Who is adored by the entire universe.
The neck of the Lord.
The neck of the Lord.
Serves to enhance.
The
beauty of the Kushtumbha gem,
the beauty of the Kushtumbha gem,
which hangs on his chest,
purple by Shri
Prabhupada. In the Upanishad it is said that the various energies of the Lord are working to create, destroy and maintain. These inconceivable varieties of energy are stored in the bosom of the Lord. As people generally say, God is all powerful. The powerless is represented by Mahalakshmi, the reservoir of all energies, who is situated on the bosom of the transcendental form of the Lord. The yogi who can meditate perfectly on that spot, on the transcendental form of the Lord, can derive many material powers, which comprise the eight perfections of the yoga system. It is stated herein that the beauty of the neck of the Lord enhances the beauty of the Kushtumbha gem rather than vice versa. The gem itself becomes more beautiful because it is situated on the neck of the Lord. A yogi is therefore recommended to meditate upon the Lord's neck. The Lord's transcendental form can either be meditated upon in the mind or placed in a temple in the form of a statue, and decorated in such a way that everyone can contemplate it. Temple worship, therefore, is meant for persons who are not so advanced, and they can meditate upon the form of the Lord. There is no difference between constantly visiting the temple and directly seeing the transcendental form of the Lord. They are of equal value. The advantageous position of the yogi is that he can sit anywhere in a solitary place and meditate upon the form of the Lord. A less advanced person, however, has to go to the temple, and as long as he does not go to the temple, he is unable to see the form of the Lord. Either by hearing, seeing, or meditating, the objective is the transcendental form of the Lord. There is no question of voidism or impersonalism. The Lord can bestow the blessings of transcendental pleasure upon either the visitor of the temple, the meditator yogi, or one who hears about the Lord's transcendental form from scriptures like the Srimad Bhagavatam or Bhagavad Gita. There are 9 processes for executing devotional service, of which smaranam, or meditation, is one. Yogis take advantage of the process of smaranam, whereas bhakti yogis take special advantage of the process of hearing and chanting. Vakshoti vasham shabashyam abhibhute pum chamano nayani vrittim medadhananam kantam chakushtum vamane haribhushanatam koyamana shakila loka namaskritasya. The yogi should then meditate on the chest of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the abode of Goddess Mahalakshmi. The Lord's chest is the source of all transcendental pleasure for the mind and full satisfaction for the eyes. The yogi should then imprint on his mind the neck of the Personality of Godhead, who is adored by the entire universe. The neck of the Lord serves to enhance the beauty of the Kushtumbha gem which hangs on his chest. Om Ajnanatimarandasya Jnanangana Salakaya Daksurun Militamina Tasmaichi Gurveinama. Sri Chaitanya Mrumbistam Chapitam Yinam Bhutale Swayam Rupa Gatamayam Tadati Spambatantikam. Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadara Shivasri Gauravakta Vrindam. Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. So this is describing the transcendental form of the Lord. The form of the Lord is very difficult to understand for those who are embodied in the material world, because the form which we have in the material world is a product of the material energy, and on account of it being a product of the material energy, it is extremely limited. The limitation of form, just like we have a form, we have a body, but our body is extremely restricted. We have very tiny capacity. We have very tiny ability. We are most insignificant in our capacity to do anything. Just like if we study our ability to create, most of us just create a nuisance, isn't it? Generally, if we look at our creative ability, we are very good at creating chaos. Most people are very good at creating some sort of chaos. And there are other people who, they don't create anything, not even chaos. They're even more useless. And those who, a little bit more inspired or qualified, they can create something. We see that there are some scientists or great personalities, so-called great personalities. They can create something. But they're not really creating. They're manipulating whatever has already been created by God. So the creative ability, although it's natural, we see that the body itself is full of all kinds of inadequacies. Our body is very inadequate, and other bodies are also very inadequate. So generally we become disgusted with bodies. Material life means, as they say, familiarity breeds contempt. So we become contemptuous towards bodies and even forms, because we spend our whole existence trying to enjoy this material body. And we realize that its capacity to enjoy is very, very small. We also have a very unsavory experience of the other types of bodies in the material world. So generally, in the material world, this idea that God should have form is actually very, very difficult to comprehend, even though we think we imagine that God should have form. But what sort of form? That is not possible to conceive. So, in the material world, everything is coming from the arrangement of material nature. Therefore, generally, everything is subjective. Everything is subjected to the arrangement of material energy. Krishna says, Maya Dakshena Prakriti Suyate Chacharacharam Hituna Nina Kuntaya Jagati Paribhartate. That this material energy is all working under my direction. So under Krishna's direction, everything is working. But the source of everything it is coming from the body of the Supreme Lord. So therefore, all of the what we call variegatedness, or the phenomena, the different arrangements of nature, they all come out of the body of God. So then one can imagine what sort of body God has. Just like from his abdomen, the whole entire planetary system of each universe is coming from the abdomen, what we call the belly button, isn't it? Just like we also have belly button, but not much happens with our belly button, isn't it? It's not a very exciting thing to have a belly button. But the belly button of God, or God's abdomen, all the entire universe is manifested, and on the stem of that universe is Lord Brahma. So we can imagine how big that abdomen is, because the stem, within the stem is all the planets. So I don't know how wide, of course, the at least according to some calculation, couple of billion miles, but it should be a very big stem. And on top of that stem is the planet of Lord Brahma. So here it also describes that on the chest of the Lord is the abode of Mahalakshmi. So Mahalakshmi is the goddess of fortune. She is the one who causes all occurrences. Everything that occurs is coming under the, if you like, energy of Lakshmi. Lakshmi Sahastra Sata Sambraman Sevyaman Govinda Nari Purushottam Tamaham Vijnanam. So Lakshmi, Lakshmi fortune. So, fortune is very important. Actually, if we study, we see that everyone wants some fortune, some good fortune. Somebody says, I made a fortune. I gained a fortune. And we say also, I was very fortunate, isn't it? We say also fortunate. So many words related with this fortune. So, the fortune, the goddess of fortune is the manifested display of the potency of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So therefore, by meditation on the chest of the Lord, the yogis, they gain all mystical powers. This vibhuti, these powers. So they have power because this is the energy of God, the power to cause all occurrences. You see, we can't conceive of that because we can make very little occur. Even though we want to make so many things happen. The struggle, as Krishna says, the struggle for existence. So in our life we are always struggling to make things happen. Isn't it? We are always making great plans. How to make things happen. Things should happen in this way. But generally, the things which actually happen are usually not predicted by us. What is that saying? All great plans of mice and men. Who knows that quote? Huh? Gangli, I can't hear. John Gleese?
No, it's
Gangli. Gangli, is it? You know the quote? What's the quote? Huh? You just remember that? All great plans of mice and men. So, this plan-making business, we see that the human being is planning things, the mice are planning, everyone is planning. But they are all completely dependent. To cause occurrence, to make things happen, this is very, very difficult for the insignificant living entity. So here it is explaining that by meditating upon, simply by meditating upon the chest of the Lord, then one can become endowed with all mystic powers. Those eight mystic perfections. Anybody knows what they are? To become lighter, to enter into stone, to float on water. Become bigger than the biggest, smaller than the smallest. To reach out, you can touch the moon. You can create a planet, destroy a planet. What else can you do, John? You can control over other people, control their minds. You can also contradict material nature. You can cause great types of magic. As Prabhupada says, you can completely contradict nature. There's one sage, he didn't like the idea of babies being born in wombs. So he decided they'd be better born on trees. So he created a tree and the babies were born on the tree. So this type of magic or power, you can create all sorts of wonderful occurrences. And with this one can have a lot of fun, isn't it? If you have some power, how much fun you can have. We don't have much fun because we have no power. You see, you can only have fun when you have some power. That's why people who have money, they have some power. They can have some fun. They can go to the Mediterranean on their big yachts, yachts the size of castles, and beautiful young ladies all adore, half naked, walking on the yacht with them, and they sit in the Mediterranean, playing in the casinos, spending 100,000 every night, 200,000, 300,000, having some nice liqueurs and nice dinner, and sleeping. Simply sleeping, eating, enjoying, because they have some power. But we have no power, so we simply have to read about them, isn't it? That's why people like to read those glossy magazines, and they read about what Charlie did, and what this, the all these names, double barrel names, the all these big posh aristocratic, Ryan Jones and Peter Smith. So many different, the Marquis of, what is it, this, and the Baron of that. So we can understand that when one has some fortune, one is born into good fortune. Good fortune means when one has very beautiful body, one who has very good education, very knowledgeable. Another good fortune. Anyone knows other good fortunes? One has very nice power, fame. One has very nice knowledge. Yeah, of course, the six opulences are there. Many varieties are there. So when one is blessed by the goddess of fortune, so therefore in India, everybody worships Durga, Lakshmi, they worship Devi, the different types of manifestation of Durga, the different 10 forms of Durga, they worship different forms. But what is the purpose of their worship is to actually get some actual power, some results, some award, to have some potency. Really, when it comes down to it, is that everybody wants to have potency. Because we are very impotent. Most people, if they study themselves, they're very pathetic, isn't it? We're really pathetic creatures. We are born in a miserable birth, miserable family, miserable relatives, miserable weather. Just like, what's your name again? Ashwari. He was saying in San Diego, if you go to California, then if you give a lecture about how miserable the material world is, they think you're some idiot. Because they're enjoying very nicely. They have what they call the golden Californian bodies, and the golden beaches, and the surfing, and they all drive around in the latest open-air cars and Cadillacs. So if you talk about misery, then here in Birmingham you can talk about misery. Everyone can understand. Yes, yes, what he's saying is correct. Because we are born into a very miserable condition of life. Material life means actually that which is extremely limited. Although we like to have some exaggerated idea of life, everyone likes to exaggerate. Well, I'm having a good time anyway. Really, things are not that bad. This miserable old preacher, is that all he talks about? Misery. Things are not that bad. Things are actually quite good. So, we see that the craving, actually craving, everyone is craving in the material world, hankering after what is actually some nice situation. That's all people really want, is a nice situation. They want to have, really, what do they want? They want good fortune. They want good fortune. That's why people always say to each other, I hope you have a good day. Did you have a nice time? Did you enjoy yourself? Isn't it? We always want to have something good. I hope you had a good day. Good wishes unto you. Good this, good that. But the problem is that generally people identify that things are going on by the arrangement of nature. But they are not. They have no idea who is the creator of nature. You see, they're trying to identify with nature. We are trying to identify with nature. But this is very foolish. Because nature is a creation. What is the meaning of nature? Nature means that works under certain rules, under certain laws. It is a systematic, just like we say, the nature of this, or the nature of that, means what we call the laws of physics. They call it the laws of physics, the laws of nature, the laws of the universe, the systems, the different measurable and, if you like, different systems that are created. But behind every law, behind every arrangement, there has to be an arranger. It is ludicrous to see a wonderful arrangement and not to actually think, well, who has arranged that? This is the problem. That the materialist is very busy looking at the arrangement. Right from the molecular to the macro, from the micro to the macro. What is the business of science is to study the arrangement. They want to see what is the arrangement in the brain, what is the arrangement in the body, isn't it? What is the arrangement in the, biosphere, or the in the ecological, you know, this new catch sort of phrase in the environment, they call it, ecological, in the ecological system. They want to see what is going on in the solar system. But as soon as you say there's a system, what is system? What does the word system mean? That everything works systematically. Like a machine. Just like if you study a machine. Any machine, you can understand that behind the machine is the mechanic, the engineer. There must be an engineer, otherwise how can there be a machine? Machine means that which works according to governed law. Certain laws, just like if you put together a combustion engine that works under certain measurable and certain distinct laws. But behind that there's an engineer. So when we talk about nature, then we must understand that behind nature that there is a supreme authority. So that doesn't require that one has to see the authority. One may say, just like in religion, they say, well, have you seen God? Isn't it? So, when you say, have you seen God, most people, obviously, being honest, will say, no, I haven't seen God. But you can see God. You can see God very clearly. Just like someone who is a... Prahlad Maharaj uses his example. What's the word for someone who can find gold in soil? There's a particular type of geologist. But they actually know. They know just by analysis whether there's a gold mine in the soil. Actually, they are paid huge amounts of money, these scientists, because they can actually, just like these oil, what is it when these people who discover oil wells? But there's particularly one, they know, there's a word for them, they know how to find gold mines by analysis of the soil. They can tell you that there's gold in this mountain. And that's how the Marwaris in India, they are, just like Prabhupada said when he was a chemist, and there was one Marwari man, he paid a huge fortune to another chemist who worked with Prabhupada, because he was good at this particular science of finding gold content in soil. So, this art of finding the gold deposits is by a science. There's a science. So similarly, there is a science to finding God in nature. You see, this is a very great science to finding God, because one may say, I can't see God, but there's so many things I can't see. Isn't it? There's so many things I can't see. It's not very unusual that I can't see God. I can't even see my eyelashes. Isn't it? So if I want to know that I've got eyelashes, then I must take assistance. What do you take assistance from? What? Yeah, you have to look in a mirror. That means you have to take shelter of a piece of glass in order to actually be convinced that you've got eyelashes. So, if one cannot see something so close as one's eyelashes, then the chances of seeing God, they are very bleak. Because God does not live here. He is not living in this mundane world. His transcendental abode is billions upon trillions of universes away, not just miles, universes. So to travel there will be very, very difficult. But there is another way which one can actually find God, and that is the science of Krishna consciousness, of understanding that Krishna is sarva karna karna. Ishvara Parama Krishna Sachit Ananda Vigraha and Adi Adi Govinda Sarva Karna Karna. So this Ishvara Krishna, his transcendental nature is Sachit Ananda Vigraha. So here we are studying Vigraha, that the form of the Lord. So we can have some idea of the form of the Lord, because what is the nature of form? Especially human form, what is the nature? So the nature of form is that it should be very beautiful. Everybody wants to see a beautiful form. Nobody likes to see an ugly form because it's unnatural. It's not natural to be ugly. That's why it's repulsive. You see? When you see someone ugly, it's not natural. Even though you can say it's natural, you say, but it's natural to be ugly. If it was natural to be ugly, then it would be acceptable. But ugliness is never acceptable. Is it? I mean, you can artificially say, well, I don't mind if you look so ugly. And I'm going to tolerate it. And everyone else will tolerate it. But it's not actually a natural thing. Because to be ugly is unnatural. You see? It's unnatural. Just the same way as deformity is unnatural. If you've got, you know, a nose, giant nose, it doesn't matter how nice a person you are. You're always going to be just the guy with the giant nose, isn't it? You might be as sweet as anything or as nice as anything, but you've got this big nose. Or when you've got these big ears. Especially if you've got a big old and a big ear. Then you've got problems. Because it's to be ugly is repulsive. It's repulsive. So people, when they see ugly people, and then they go, oh, hello, 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 they try to be nice. Because they don't want to make that person conscious. God, you're ugly, isn't it? They don't want like that. They want to be polite and say, oh, you're a nice person, or cheer them up. But actually they're ugly. So ugliness is completely unnatural. So therefore, with intelligence we can understand that there should be no ugliness in the form of God, isn't it? Suppose you had this vision of God and he looked pretty ugly. Huh? After all those years of chanting Hare Bols and Hare Krishnas and doing your rounds and your tapasyas, and there God turned up and you're like, oh no. Huh? So this is another way of seeing God, to understand that what is the nature of God, that God should be most beautiful. Why should God be the most beautiful? It has to be logical. Because all beauty comes from God. In the arrangement, there must also be the same, if you like, in what we call relativity. Of course, in the material world, things we understand things in relative sense. But to understand that the potency or the energetic must also have much more than the energy. Because the energy is only one aspect of the energetic. When we deal with an inconceivable or unlimited concept such as God, that means that Krishna says to Arjuna in the Bhagavad Gita, whatever you are seeing in this world, which is wonderful, these are only a little spark of my tiny fragment. Not even worth. Because what can we see to begin with? We see very, very little. But whatever of these opulences you are seeing, they are only one tiny spark of my splendor. So therefore, whatever beauty you are seeing in this world, it is only a tiny, insignificant, perverted reflection of the beauty that's in God. So we can study God, as Prabhupada says, there's possibility to study God in a very limited way, when you understand that your form is a reflection or a perverted reflection of the form of God, that God has form, but he doesn't have material form. So here Bhagavatam is describing what is the unlimited power of God's form, that simply by meditating upon the chest of the Lord, then one can immediately become empowered with all mystical opulences. So this is the power of meditation on God. So one should not in any way think that this is exaggeration. This is not exaggeration. Just like we see in the example, the four kumaras, simply by smelling the tulsi that were offered to the feet of God, they became the most powerful yogis in the whole universe. They're considered to be the most powerful yogis. Similarly, there are many, many examples, these different processes, sravanam, kirtanam, and Vishnu smaranam. So just like Bali Maharaj, just by offering some land to Vamanadeva, three pieces of land, which is not a big offering, is it? Brahmana was only a small boy, Brahmacharya. So he gave him 3 steps. Whatever he could cover in his 3 steps. And by that offering to the Lord, he became celebrated as a very wonderful Mahajan devotee. Then Sukadeva Goswami, by reciting the Srimad Bhagavatam, became most famous as the most powerful devotee. Parikshit Maharaj, simply by hearing the Bhagavatam, like that. So these are all examples of the perfection of the simple process of associating with Krishna. This process of associating with Krishna is so powerful. Just like we are in the situation we're in now, on account of what? Why are we where we are now? Well, because of association with Maya. The living entity is always dependent on association. So we are associating with the material nature from time immemorial. So whatever we've got now, which is not a lot, is it? We ain't got money. Have we got money? We haven't got money. We've got a little bit of physical strength. We haven't got much beauty. We're all broke. We've got all these big plans we're going to do in life. But we don't know how we're going to do it, because we can't afford it anyway. We can't even get ourselves to India with the struggle to get a fare. So, materially speaking, we have been serving the material energy since time immemorial. We've been associating with Maya, with the bodily concept of life. And this is the result. So now what Krishna consciousness is saying, this process of Krishna consciousness is simply telling us that now, Tata, Brahma Jignasya, now in this human form of life, we have opportunity, very wonderful opportunity, to associate with Krishna. So therefore, that association with Krishna can be brought about very swiftly and very easy by chanting. By chanting in Ketana. So there is these 9 processes of Bhakti Yoga: Shravanam, Ketanam, Smaranam. So Shravanam, Ketanam, Smaranam, these are very, very powerful processes. Just like we are talking. And in that talking we are explaining the, if you like, the potency of Krishna, but also to see Krishna's potency within the material world. That is also very important, because you should understand that Krishna is, as we say, Achintya Bheda Abheda Tapa, that the Supreme Personality of Godhead is simultaneously one and different from His energy. So within His energies, God is also there. So therefore, we can understand something about the Personality of Godhead by study of His various energies. And what is the thing we can understand from all of His energies? That they are all personal. This is the most important thing to understand. Srimad Bhagavatam is pointing out that all of the energies of God, they are all personal. That's why this understanding of demigods is very, very important. One should not minimize it, to understand how Krishna is administering the universe. All of them are persons. There is a personality controlling over every single function of your body. There is a personality controlling every single function of nature. There is a personality controlling everything, just like we can see that even in an impersonal thing like a society, there are so many personalities controlling. There's a personality deciding when the rubbish is collected. There's a personality deciding how much electricity you get. There's a personality deciding how much you can behave or misbehave. There's a personality collecting your taxes. There's a personality making sure that you do this and do that. There are so many personalities involved. So we should understand that behind all of Krishna's energies, all of Krishna's energies are completely personal. Everything is personal. Therefore, When one is convinced of the personal nature of energy, in the material world, everyone is actually due to some inauspiciousness. They are always thinking that energy is impersonal. This is our demonic mentality. That because energy is powerful, people don't associate power with people. Because most people don't have much power. You see, this is kind of anthropomorphic, or this concept that projecting our own feeble understanding of persons onto higher authority. Because just like in the material world, we see that people are fascinated by anyone who has any power. There's an attraction, there's almost an obsession sometimes. Because it's so rare to find in the material world anyone who has any real power. But at the same time, we can understand that behind everything, there has to be an intelligence. There's an intelligent arranger. As soon as there's an arrangement, there's an arranger. And we readily accept that when we talk about the goings-on in the material world, the basic arrangements are required. Just like everyone is catching a bus, they're catching a train, they're going to work, they're going to offices, they've got machines, they've got so many arrangements in a single day, isn't it, Ravi? In one single day, you require so many arrangements. If you pull the toilet, you want it to flush. If you put the light on, the electricity should come on. If you put the gas on, it should work. If you go out to wait for a bus, it should come along. Everyone is dependent, completely dependent on so many arrangements. Now, what is the reason that there's a need of so many arrangements? Why are we dependent on so many arrangements? Exactly. Because we are so incapacitated. We are so weak. We are so feeble. Really, we are so useless. Like children. A child is completely dependent on the arrangement of the mother. Isn't it? If you leave the child there, it will die. It cannot possibly be expected to make its own arrangements. So, naturally, any intelligent person can understand that when there's the more complex the arrangement, the more proof there's God. Or at least there's someone greater than me making that arrangement. But not for the atheists. Because their idea is the more complex the energy, then the idea of any personalization is totally humbug or speculative. That energy itself should be somehow impersonal. So then when they study the Vedic literatures, they see this as a kind of mythological concept, that there should be personalities behind the goings-on of the universe. But what is the meaning of personality? Personality means capacity, intelligence, just like we see that intelligence, we haven't seen any intelligence that's not in a body. Has anyone actually seen an intelligence outside of a body? So then how can they conclude that anything intelligent can happen outside of a body? Where is the basis of their speculative assertion? How can they say? In other words, every single intelligent thing that happens, in our estimation, it happens because of some intelligent arrangement. As soon as there's something intelligent going on, then you must then assume that there must be some intelligence behind that intelligent thing. So, when there is intelligence, then there must be a personality. Now, the fact that you can't see that personality, then one doubts whether such a personality exists. Just like an ant is also a person, but the ant can never be aware of the human presence in a room. So does that mean in the ant society that they are atheists? Are they atheists against humans? They don't believe in humans. It's quite possible. They probably never even considered the idea of a human. they probably never even had a conversation about it, even though there might be thousands of humans around them. Because within their very tiny, limited bodies, limited domain, then there's no concept, there's no possibility. So similarly, the idea for the materialist to understand that the idea of body is very, very difficult for those who are embodied. It's very, very difficult, because as soon as you're embodied, then you automatically speculate that any other body should be like mine. They should be like mine. The idea that some more powerful body, like the frog in the well, is thinking that everything that's going on is going on within the jurisdiction of the well. So the idea that there could be something greater going on outside the well is very difficult. So here the descriptions of the personality of God, that God from his navel, all the universe is coming. Actually, first of all, from God's body, from the pores of his skin, all the universes are coming out. Billions upon billions upon billions of universes are coming out from the body of Mahavishnu. And then, from within those universes, the Mahavishnu is expanding himself as Garbhadakshai Vishnu. Garbha means lying in the ocean of sweat or water, at the bottom of the ocean, at the bottom of the universe. And from his navel, he is manifesting unlimited planets. And on the top of that lotus is Lord Brahma. With our body, none of those things are possible. So, therefore, people generally are very skeptical or very much unconvinced about the idea of God. So, Srimad Bhagavatam is the beautiful story of the personality of God, and therefore it is describing how within the heart of every living entity, so every living entity within the heart, this most beautiful form of Krishna is there, in the heart. So those who are advanced, they can see that form within the heart. If you can't see the form within your heart, then you are a neophyte. Neophyte devotee. That's why here it says, only the neophytes, they need to go to the temple. So temple life means neophyte life. Because a neophyte is one who can't see anything in his heart. Only darkness. Isn't it? Let's all have a look in our hearts now to see what's in there. Anyone see anything? So it means we're neophyte. So in this age, everyone is neophyte. No one should be proud that he's very advanced. Actually, we're all sudras, lower than sudras. In this age, we're born very low, low-class characters. So, therefore, this meditation upon the super soul in this age is not possible. It's not possible. At the time of Kapila, when he appeared millions of years ago, then it was possible. They were very advanced, and they could actually, by meditation, their hearts were so pure that the Supreme Personality of God would appear on the lotus of their hearts. But in Kali Yuga, we have so much junk in our heart that the only thing you'll find in there is a few ghosts, a few hobgoblins, a few characters that are floating around in the ether. They've all taken up residence there. So if you look in your heart too much, you might find the wrong thing. But previously in Satya Yuga, Treta Yuga, there was possibility. The Dwapara Yuga was the introduction of deity worship, and Kali Yuga, even deity worship is such a big burden. Nobody wants to even worship the deities now. There's temples with 400 devotees where they have to advertise for pujaris to come from outside. So, this is Kali Yuga. Kali Yuga means no attraction for Krishna. There's no attraction. As Lord Chaitanya says, but unfortunate as I am, I have no attraction. So Lord Chaitanya is describing the unfortunate condition of Kali Yuga. What is the nature of Kali Yuga? No attraction. People are not attracted to philosophy, they're not attracted to rules, they're not attracted to regulations, they're not attracted to austerity, they're not attracted to truthfulness, they're not attracted to cleanliness. Isn't it? They're not attracted to being merciful. There are no attractions. But lots of attraction for intoxication. Any type of intoxication going, illicit sex. People are mad after magazines, films, videos, anything about sex, and they're attracted like bees to the honey or flies to the stool, whichever example you want to use. So intoxicating, meeting, gambling, we're very attracted to quarrel in this age. Everybody loves a good quarrel, isn't it? We can't live together for even one day, and we want to find a reason to fault find. We're very attracted to fault finding each other, looking for some defects, like scientists scrutinizing the atom. We scrutinize each other to see, hey, look, I found a fault. Hey, I'm going to get that guy later. I found. So this is our hearts in Kali Yuga. Sumanda, very lazy, and so many different inauspiciousness are in the heart. So very hard to find Krishna in there. Just like you can't find the beautiful swans in the, the sewage tanks, isn't it? You can't find Krishna in the sewage of our heart. But in Kali Yuga there is one beauty of this age, and that is that the Supreme Personality of Godhead has descended as Sri Krishna Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, and he is very kind on the these poor wretches of Kali Yuga. He's very, very merciful, very, very kind. So all he's asking is that you meditate on sound, because sound is very powerful, and you can make a loud sound also. So people in Kali Yuga, they like to make a lot of loud sound, isn't it? Everyone's always shouting when they talk practically, they shout. So even loud sound or soft sound, you can make soft sound, loud sound, or in-between sound. But that sound should be glorifying, kirtana. Kirtana means to glorify Krishna. So Lord Chaitanya has come to show the potency, the power of glorifying Krishna in this age. It has become very empowered. Of course, it's always unlimitedly powerful, but in this age, this glorification of Krishna is a very powerful process. Chanting Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. And when you chant the holy names, then Krishna will appear on the lotus of your heart. One day, Prabhupada said, you will see Krishna face to face. But devotee is not anxious to see Krishna. But devotee is anxious to glorify Krishna. One should not be anxious to see Krishna. Krishna is not your servant. He doesn't have to come by your call. Just like if I call, hey, Ravi, come here, then Ravi may come. But if I go, hey, Krishna, come here, no. Krishna is not subjected to my authority. So therefore, one should not chant to see Krishna. One should chant, what is the meaning of chanting, so that one may serve Krishna. So, Hare, my dear Radharani, please engage me. I am very fallen. I am simply a low cockroach. Or as Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami says, I am the worm in the stool. So that's a good example, worm in the stool. Because what is the nature of a worm in the stool? Actually, even a worm in the stool is puffed up. When he gets to the top of the stool, he thinks, hey, look, I'm on the top. Isn't it? So like that, we are in the stool of the material world, and we're thinking we're getting somewhere. So, worm in the stool, then if one is thinking that truly thinking like that, then one can chant the holy name of the Lord in a humble state of mind, thinking oneself lower than the straw in the street, more tolerant than the tree, devoid of all sense of false prestige. In such a state of mind, one can chant the holy name of the Lord constantly. So when there is some humility and sincere chanting, then one will become more and more anxious. This ruchi will develop, this taste will develop, and then as Rupa Goswami Prabhupada says, that even if I had a million tongues, I could not fully chant or be able to taste the nectar of these holy names. So just like here it is explaining that if you see the form of God, then even if you have millions of eyes, you can say, even with millions of eyes, how can I drink the nectar of the beautiful form of Krishna? So, just like the gopis, they are cursing Lord Brahma that, you stupid creator, you have made these eyelashes. You see? Now when you blink, imagine you blink. See, you blink there. So they are so disappointed that they blink, because in that blinking, then Krishna is out of their view. For that momentary blinking of the eyes. Therefore they are criticizing Lord Brahma that, you're not a very good creator, that you've made that we blink, therefore we can't see Krishna. So similarly with the chanting of Hare Krishna mantra, when one is actually sincerely chanting in the proper mood, then one will, even with a million ears, will not be able to sufficiently taste the nectar of Krishna's name, because Krishna's name and Krishna are absolutely no different. So therefore, if you also meditate upon the name of Krishna, you can also have all of these mystic offerings. Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur said that Raghunath Das Goswami had the 8 mystic perfections in unlimited quantity. Unlimited. Now we may say limited, but unlimited, he's saying unlimited. But he was such a great devotee that not only was he not interested in the mystic perfection, so one can imagine that he wasn't very interested in material life. Not only was he not interested in the mystic perfections, he was not even interested in anything except having the service of Srimati Radharani. So there's one very nice verse how Raghunath Das is saying that, I do not care even for Vrindavan or the killer of Baku, Krishna, without the service of Srimati Radharani. So such a state of renunciation is not possible, not imaginable by an ordinary living entity. So therefore, if one chants sincerely Hare Krishna mantra in proper mood, then one is the same as meditating upon the transcendental form of Krishna. Otherwise, if one is not chanting sincerely, then sometimes one is only getting alphabet. Bhakti Siddhanta also said, chanting the alphabet, A, B, C, D, E, F, G. Okay, is there any questions at all? Anybody have any questions? Well, they're not elements. They are the chit-shakti, or the spiritual energy of God. So the thing is, when we deal with energy, naturally, these two things, if you study energy without knowing the energetic, then that's a very incomplete study of energy. Because obviously, just like we see the light coming out of the ceiling, but we can't ascertain that the ceiling is given light. So some less intelligent person could say, oh, if I stick a bulb in the ceiling, then light will come. Isn't it? So you can go around the wall sticking bulbs in. But why the light doesn't come? Because you're studying the effect, but not the cause. So what science is studying is the effect. And because the effect is only a small portion of the whole picture, then therefore their conclusions are always imperfect or defective, because without understanding what is the cause. So as we say, sarva karna karnam, that Krishna is the cause of all causes. So that understanding of effect, just like we see an intelligent effect in nature, so many intelligent effects. The effect is intelligent. So why shouldn't the cause be intelligent? This is our question. If the effect is intelligent, just like it's intelligent that you've got a stomach, isn't it? Because if you didn't have a stomach, how could you eat? It's also quite intelligent that food should be digestible in your stomach. And then there's a whole system of digestion which allows the food to be distributed throughout the body. So there's so many arrangements, and they're quite intelligent. Okay, you may think you have a better arrangement. Just like, take as an example, milk, yogurt, cheese, and cream, butter, ghee. They come from a very intelligent arrangement, because if you put a bowl of yogurt out there, it'll go off, isn't it? It'll only last so long. But grass can last for, it goes on and on reproducing itself over millions of years. Now, within the grass is stored hundreds and thousands of millions of tons of yogurt. There's also hundreds and thousands of millions of tons of milk and butter and ghee. It's all there, out there in the grass. You see? But if you go out there looking for yogurt, you won't find it. Isn't it? No matter how much grass you eat, you won't get yogurt. So Krishna has made a wonderful arrangement that a cow eats the grass, which is useless to humans, not much good to humans. So the cow eats the grass, and that same cow produces very nice, thick, creamy yogurt. When you go to Safeways, when you're deviating from Sankirtan, you go in and buy this big thing of yogurt. I don't know if devotees still do that, but that used to be a favorite pastime, buying yogurt with dates and butter or whatever. So when you drink that yogurt, then where is it coming from? It's coming from an arrangement. Now, let man, who's extremely intelligent, man, scientist, let them make a machine that you just put it out in the grass and it produces yogurt. All these big yogurt companies and these big butter companies and these big milk companies, well, wouldn't they? What a machine. You just stick it out there and it just goes around the field all day. And from the, out of its back comes all of this yogurt and ghee and butter, cream, milk. Let them create such a machine, then we can call them intelligent. All they can do is they have a machine for packaging the yogurt. They make some nice packaging arrangement and then they say, Safeway's yogurt or Edenvale butter or something like that. So if anyone is intelligent, he can understand that simply that one arrangement of storing up millions upon billions of tons of cream, yogurt, ghee, and milk in grass. Because if it wasn't in the grass, how could it come out? Isn't it? Think about it. If that thing isn't in the grass, just like when you get fruit, there's a flavor. That must be in the earth. Otherwise, how does it come out? Isn't it? Or am I not making sense?
Because sometimes they don't give the cows grass. They sometimes give them other things.
They don't give them grass?
Sometimes they give them other.
No, they give them from the earth. They have to give them something produced from the earth.
Yeah.
So what I'm saying is within the earth is the mother earth, and she's providing all of these things. So she's providing through the grass, the earth, as in you can't, you have to find it another way. You may feed the animals different things, but generally they're produced from the earth. Just like your wife produces milk, she doesn't eat grass, but it's from the earth. Do you eat grass?
No.
So it's not a point of grass, it's a point that within the earth is stored all of these things. But from that arrangement, these things are coming out. So that means stored within that earth is billions of tons of vegetables, milk, ghee, yogurt, fruits. You see? And there's an arrangement for them to be stored, because any company that harvests a crop, they've immediately got the huge problem of storage. That's why the British government regularly throw millions of tons of food into the sea. Because they can't store it. It costs billions and billions of dollars to store it. But nature can store all of that. By what? By a very intelligent arrangement. Just like water. To store water is actually very difficult because it becomes contaminated, isn't it? So you've got a problem. As soon as you've got a cup of water, you can't leave it all the time. You have to drink it or throw it away after some time because it becomes polluted. So therefore, to have pure water is not an easy factor. That's why you pay for one bottle this size, £1.30, for pure water. It's called distilled water. you go to any, what do you call it, for a battery, you have to use distilled water. So it costs £1.30 for one bottle. Like a bottle of milk, you'll pay £1.30. So imagine the humans require billions of tons of water. And how to keep it distilled? Then that has to be done by the sun. So it's distilled by the sun, stored in the clouds. If you want to move a bucket of water from this room to the next room, let's say you have a bucket this size, you try and pick it up. And yet, by a wonderful arrangement in nature, the water is being carried now by these big clouds, millions of tons of water. And that will be deposited on the mountains and stored as ice. And then in the summertime, that water becomes released. So in that way, there's perfect arrangement in nature. Very extremely intelligent arrangement. And if you study the what we call relativity, the relationship between things, you find that there's an extremely intelligent relationship with everything. Everything has a perfect arrangement. Just like the planets. When the planets move, your body is affected. So all of these planets within the universe, all these planets that are there, they're all affecting various ways the whole mechanism. Just like a watch. In a watch you've got all the little mechanisms, but they're all part of one big mechanism. So the universe is a huge mechanism. Huge arrangement. And one must also see that if there is an intelligence within the arrangement, then one must conclude that there must be some intelligence behind it. How can you have something in the effect which is not in the cause? So if you say there is any intelligence in nature, that means behind the effect, the cause must have intelligence. Now if the cause has got intelligence, then the only intelligence that we know of, and the only intelligence is actually in a personality. In other words, intelligence comes from a brain, isn't it? Now even a human brain has intelligence. So why not accept that there are higher brains than humans? But they can't accept that. They can't accept that there's higher brains than humans. Because their idea is that in the universe, the whole thing is that the humans are the only intelligent people. I mean, whatever reason they come to that conclusion, that is their conclusion. That we are the only intelligent creatures. Therefore, how can there be anything intelligent going on that we didn't do? Such a narrow, such a very restricted concept of existence that they think that what is going on. So, this is very foolish, childish philosophy. Because everything that happens to them is outside of their control, and yet they're saying that there can't be anything higher than them. Completely childish. Every single thing that goes on, you have nothing to do with it. There's nothing to do with you whatsoever. Your body, how it works, how it lives, how it dies, how it exists, how it's maintained, how it's destroyed, all of these things are completely and utterly beyond your control. But they are thinking that we are the most intelligent thing in the universe. So how they come to that conclusion, God only knows. Because actually, they have no justification. It's like, if you are totally controlled, how can you say that there's no controller? You can say there's no controller if there's no control. Or if you're not controlled, you may be able to say there's no control. But if you're controlled and everything around you is controlled, how can you say there's no controller? Childish. Anyway, I don't know what the original question was.
I just said that these of you are going to go, you know that we have form, and the intelligence is something that is coming from form. So it's not itself, form the intelligence itself. Right? So when we say that Krishna's body is made of intelligence, it's, when we say that
well, what you got to understand is that in the God is not made of intelligence, because intelligence is a material element. Earth, water, fire, air, ether, mind, intelligence and ego. So God is not made up of intelligence. But intelligence comes from God. What God is, that God is made up of Sat Chit Ananda. And of course this Chit potency is not a material estimatable thing. You can't compare it to anything material. Because Chit means consciousness. So generally we see that consciousness is intelligent. That the intelligence comes. Just like if you have an Einstein, when he's alive, he's intelligent. When he's dead, he's not very intelligent. Is it? He doesn't do anything intelligent when he's dead. So we can understand that intelligence comes from consciousness. So at the moment, intelligence is manifested through the mechanisms of the body. And within that body, there is a different levels of arrangement. Earth, water, fire, air, ether, mind, intelligence, ego. They're all different arrangements. So one cannot actually talk about real intelligence unless one understands it from the transcendental plane. Because that is the chit potency of God. So everything in the spiritual world is pure chit, pure consciousness. Air consciousness is mixed up with inferior substances. So there's an inferior display. Because it's mixed up with inferior. Just like if you have a very tiny speck of, what do you call it, fire, little tiny molecular spark of fire, you mix it up with the wet grass, it becomes very dim, dark. So in the material world, consciousness is practically in a state of, as it says in the suspended state. Our consciousness is very, very dull in the material world. So what we call intelligent activity in the material world is a very relative thing. Cannot be compared to the activities of God or the personality of God like that. So you can't say it's the same type of intelligence, because the intelligent display in the material world is relative to the particular type of body that we have. But we should not put God in the same category, that somehow God's intelligence is also something relative. Because there's no difference between God's consciousness and God. There's no difference between God's form and God. There's no difference between God's paraphernalia and God. There's no difference between the manifestation of the spiritual world and God Himself. That's the meaning of absolute. Here, there is difference. There's difference between you and your body. There's difference between the arrangements in nature. All of these things are, they're all working on their own, if you like. As Krishna says, this is my separated energy, under a separated mechanism. Okay, Srimad Bhagavatam Apuranam Ki Jaya, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jaya.